Good evening, everybody. Thank you all so much for coming out and braving the rainy evening here. I'm Lissa Muscatine. I'm one of the co-owners of Politics and Prose Bookstore. Thank you. As you know, we have a very treasured, in our view, and long, wonderful partnership with our friends here at Sixth and I. We host some of our favorite author events in this beautiful, beautiful space. And so I just want to thank Esther and Jackie and all of the people here. So please give them a hand. They are doing an incredible job with this wonderful, wonderful space. And we share with them a real mission to strengthen and build our community here in D.C. It's such a pleasure to host Gloria Steinem this evening. As you know, she'll be talking about her new book. It's called My Life on the Road. We were counting up her previous books, and you know there are a bunch of bestsellers on the list. We think this is her seventh, but it sort of depends how you count. But in any case, she's very prolific, obviously. And once you read this, I'm sure you're going to find it as compelling and engaging as her writing always is. Now, to do a proper introduction of Gloria Steinem would take up the entire hour, which I don't think you want me to do. And that's because of the number of causes she's championed, the advocacy groups she's conceived and nurtured, the articles and essays and books she's written, speeches she's given, campaigns she's organized, magazines she's launched, and the award she has won. So I'm just going to mention a few of the top highlights. I think everybody in the room knows she was the co-founder of Ms. Magazine in 1972 and its editor for many years. She founded the National Women's Political Caucus, so if you're old enough, you'll know that that was one of the first politically centered advocacy groups for women. And in 2013, and this is pretty amazing, and totally deserved, she received the nation's highest civilian honor, the Presidential Medal of Freedom, and it was awarded by President Obama. Perhaps less quantifiable, but no less important, is the sheer impact of her words and ideas on the political and social discourse of our country over more than five decades. In her new book, My Life on the Road, it's really one story told through many stories about her life's journeys, and I say journeys, not journey on purpose. The road she's traveled, the people she's met, the books she's read, the ideas she's considered, from an itinerant childhood to her eventual discovery of what a real home means, and that was fairly late in life. She's, of course, a wonderful writer, a superb storyteller, and a woman whose willingness to speak truth to power has given backbone over half a century to the fight for the rights of women, people of color, the poor, children, and pretty much everyone on society's margins. Like many of you in the audience tonight, I suspect, I grew up on Ms. Magazine, and thanks to Gloria Steinem, I have proudly labeled myself a feminist ever since. And I know that I'm not alone, Gloria, in very deeply appreciating that you have literally spent your entire life giving voice to the aspirations and ambitions of hundreds of millions of women worldwide, and by extension, their families, their communities, their countries, and really all of us. So thank you so much for being such an inspiration. Tonight, Gloria will be in conversation with another of our nation's most influential advocates and activists, Maxine Waters. Now in her 13th term in the U.S. House of Representatives and representing a diverse and fascinating district in South Central Los Angeles, Congressman Waters has earned a reputation over her career for being fearless, outspoken, relentless, and above all, effective. She was an unstoppable agent of change, and I remember this, I grew up in California during more than a decade in the California State Assembly, where she fought for the divestment of state pension funds from South Africa and worked to protect affirmative action. She's been the same determined leader in Congress and in the National Democratic Party, a true champion of equality and social justice. And if you've had a chance already to read the book, you'll learn that Maxine Waters and Gloria Steinem actually first crossed paths at a seminal event back in 1977, the National Women's Conference in Houston. Let's just say the world has never been the same since, and for the better. So please join me in welcoming Gloria Steinem and Congressman Maxine Waters.
we need something first.
Well, this is the beginning of another book, is all I can say. You have to promise me. Do you all know each other in this room? I feel that I mean, there's so many people I know, and Maxine knows, and we have to organize tonight. All right. So we're going to talk for a bit, but half the time belongs to you. So this is, you know, trouble is going to result from the fact that we were together tonight. But this is a conversation. So, Maxine.
Well, Gloria and I have a lot to talk about, but we can't talk about it in front of all of you. Gloria Steinem changed my life. I met her in 1977, as was said, at that wonderful conference that we had in Houston. I'd never seen anybody like Gloria Steinem and Bella Abzug. And Bella Abzug was one of Gloria's dearest friends in life. She loved her so much. And Bella shouted at her all the time. And I finally said to Gloria, "Why do you let her talk to you that way?" And Gloria said, "This is the way we talk to each other in New York."
No, I remember that so clearly because Maxine, we did not know each other, and Bella really was shouting at me. You know, as if you know Bella, you knew that she just shouted at you about how terrible something was, and you waited until she finished, and then you explained why you did it, and she said, "Oh, well, maybe you're right," and she went on. And I could see Maxine looking appalled at this. And I did say, "This is just the way we talk in New York," which isn't actually true, but I was trying to comfort her.
And so, you know, at the conference, many of us were there not knowing what we were supposed to do and how we were supposed to do it. And so as a few days went by, we started to try and organize, and I got involved with organizing the minority caucus. And we said we had a lot to say, but we didn't really know how to write it. So Gloria was drafted to write everything for everybody. And we dictated to her much of what we wanted to say. And not only did I get a chance to do the preamble as the book states, you know, to the minority plank, but the most wonderful thing was following that, she asked me to join the board of Ms. Foundation, and I did. And I was a member of the California State Assembly at that time, and all of the ideas that I had about trying to create opportunities for women, becoming a feminist, I took those ideas to the California State Legislature, and I was able to get many of them signed into law. And one that I'll just share with you was, at the time that I was in the California State Assembly, insurance companies would not pay for the buildup after mastectomies. They said it was cosmetic surgery. But now I was a feminist. I wasn't going for that. And so because of my being able to serve on the board and witness all of these proposals that came in unsolicited, I learned to move on things like that. And of course, I had it signed into law. But my life changed because of Gloria Steinem. And I ended up in New York every month or so and met so many different people. And Gloria was, you know, I had not met such a woman before in my life. And here was this woman who was young, who I thought should have been a model. And here she was organizing and working, and she was way outside of the box. She was dating a black man. And so, we had these wonderful, wonderful times together, and we reminisced a lot about what we were going to do later on in life. And here we are later on in life. And we have not organized a village yet where we're all going to end up staying. But this book that Gloria has written really does tell you who she is, what she cares about, and the experiences that she's had It's wonderful reading. I won't tell you any more, say much more about it, except Gloria doesn't know what impact she had on my life in so many ways. And the stories she told, I remember them all. And when I read about her mother in this book, it was just like talking to Gloria all over again, and she explaining to me what had happened in her life with her mom. So thank you, Gloria.
No, thank you. And, you know, Maxine has always been in the forefront. We haven't planned this conversation, right? But just now I was thinking about your struggle in California to keep the cops from doing internal searches of women.
That's right.
They stopped for traffic reasons.
That's right.
Right? And there was just such another story in the press from another state. But what we have discovered about the mistreatment of women, what Black Lives Matter is saying, what, you know, Maxine has always been there. And if any other woman wins the presidency, it will be because Maxine and Barbara Lee and Barbara Mikulski and, you know, all the people who have been out there proving that women can be respected in authority in public life, it will be because all of those women, and Maxine especially in so many ways, have demonstrated that women's authority in public life is okay, is normal, is good, is positive. Because otherwise, I think we're so used to seeing women only in child rearing. Women, too. You know, we associate female authority with nurturing and emotion and things inside the home. We see male authority as rational and appropriate to affairs outside the home. I think that's part of the reason that it's hard for some women, too, and especially for men. I think about it when I see some of the grown-up guys on television saying ridiculous things about I'm thinking about 2008 now, when Hillary Clinton, took all this shit, and the, big grown-up news guys were saying, I cross my legs when I see her. She reminds me of my first wife waiting outside the alimony court. I mean, hello? And I think in a way they felt regressed to childhood because that was the last time they thought they saw a woman in authority. So, Maxine has so helped to change that, to open up a space for female talent of all kinds in public life. And I'm just so grateful for that. Now, the problem is we don't get to see each other enough. So we're really here to see each other.
Well, as I said, I started my trips to New York because of Ms. And met wonderful women, and I could recall, I could, but I won't, many of the meetings that we had. Tell them about Marlo Thomas in those meetings, and Free to Be. Mm-hmm. I remember all of that, that Gloria supported, and we had some very, very talented women who were true feminists. And I want to tell you, you might be a little bit surprised, but for me to identify myself as a feminist back in the day, Black women said, what are you talking about? You can't be a feminist. That's a white woman's thing.
This is so wrong. To me, Black women invented feminism disproportionately.
I know, but all of that gets distorted. But I think people would like to hear about some of these trips. I had just an opportunity to read part of the preface here, and I think the story that you told about being in this place where the bikers
mm-hmm.
were.
Oh, okay, all right.
And it's so wonderfully written. And it is so absolutely educational about how you must not think about people based on what you think you see. Mm-hmm. But if you just stop and talk with folks, you can learn an awful lot. Could you share that?
Yeah, I think the road is my substitute for meditation. You know, all my friends tell me that I should meditate. Mindfulness, I've taken courses. I never do it, okay? But I think that's partly because the road is my form of it. It forces you to live in the present. It forces you to be, you know, alive with all your senses and to question all your suppositions. So I will read this, which is the prelude to the book, and then I have another section which is supposed to lead us into organizing, but we can wait for a while.
Okay.
I board a plane for Rapid City, South Dakota, and see a lot of people in black leather, chains, and tattoos. Airline passengers usually look like where they're going, business suits to Washington, D.C., jeans to L.A., but I can't imagine a convention of such unconventional visitors in Rapid City. It's the kind of town where people still angle park their cars in front of the movie palace. My bearded seatmate is asleep in his studded jacket and nose ring, so I just accept one more mystery of the road. At the airport, I meet five female friends from different parts of the country. We are a diverse group of women, a Cherokee activist and her grown-up daughter, who's here, Rebecca Adamson, who was the Cherokee activist, okay. Two African-American writers and one musician and me. We've been invited to a Lakota Sioux powwow celebrating the powerful place that women held before patriarchy arrived from Europe and efforts now to restore that place. As we drive toward the Badlands, we see an acre of motorcycles around each isolated diner and motel. This solves the mystery of the leather and the chains, but it creates another. When we stop for coffee, our waitress can't believe that we don't know. Every August since 1938, bikers from all over the world have come here for a rally named after Sturgis, a town that's just a wide place in the road. They are drawn by the sparsely populated space of forests, mountains, and a grid of highways so straight that it is recognizable from outer space. Right now, about 250,000 bikers are filling every motel and campground within 500 miles. Our band of six strong women takes note. The truth is, we are a little afraid of so many bikers in one place. How could we not be? We have learned from movies that the bikers travel in packs, treat women like possessions, and may see other women as sexual fair game. But we don't run into the bikers because we spend our days traveling down unmarked roads past the last stand of trees in Indian country. We eat home-cooked food brought in trucks, sit on blankets around powwow grounds where dancers follow the heartbeat of drums, and watch Indian ponies as decorated as the dancers. When it rains, a rainbow stretches from can't see to can't see, and fields of wet sweetgrass become as fragrant as gigantic flowers. Only when we return late each night to our cabins do we see motorcycles in the parking lot. While walking in Rapid City, I hear a biker say to his tattooed woman partner, "Honey, shop as long as you want. I'll meet you at the cappuccino place." I assume this is an aberration. On our last morning, I enter the lodge alone for an early breakfast, trying to remain both inconspicuous and open-minded. Still, I'm hyper-conscious of a room full of knife sheaths, jackboots, and very few women. In the booth next to me, a man with chains around his muscles and a woman in leather pants and an improbable hairdo are taking note of my presence. Finally, the woman comes over to talk. "I just want to tell you," she says cheerfully, "how much Ms. Magazine has meant to me over the years." and my husband too. He reads some now that he's retired. But what I wanted to ask, isn't one of the women you're traveling with Alice Walker? I love her poetry. It turns out that she and her husband have been coming to this motorcycle rally every year since they were first married. She loves the freedom of the road and also the mysterious moonscape of the Badlands. She urges me to walk there, but to follow the paths marked by ropes. During the war over the sacred Black Hills, she explains, Lakota warriors found refuge there because the cavalry got lost every time. Her husband says, stops by on his way to the cashier and suggests I see the huge statue of Crazy Horse that's being dynamited out of the Black Hills. Crazy Horse riding his pony, he says, is going to make all those Indian-killing presidents on Mount Rushmore look like nothing. He walks away, a gentle, lumbering man, tattoos, chains, and all. Before she leaves, my new friend tells me to look out the big picture window at the parking lot. See that purple Harley out there? The big, gorgeous one? That's mine. I used to ride behind my husband and never took the road on my own. Then after the kids were grown, I put my foot down. It was hard, but we finally got to be partners. Now he says he likes it better this way. He doesn't have to worry about his bike breaking down or getting a heart attack and totaling us both. I even put Ms. on my license plate. And you should see my grandkids' faces when Grandma rides up on her purple Harley. On my own again, I look out at the barren sand and tortured rocks of the Badlands stretching for miles. I've walked there, and I know that close up, the barren sand reveals layers of pale beige and rose and cream, and the rocks turn out to have intricate womb-like openings. Even in the distant cliffs, caves of rescue appear. What seems to be one thing from a distance is very different close up. I tell you this story because it's the kind of lesson that can be learned only on the road, and also because I've come to believe that inside, each of us has a purple motorcycle. We have only to discover it and ride.
I thought you'd enjoy that also. I loved it, but even more than the actual story and the lesson that's taught in the story, the way Gloria writes is so wonderful, and the descriptive nature of her writing as she describes the landscape and all of those things is just so wonderful and easy reading. It's like, you know, you're talking to her. And so I know she had some other things that she wanted to read, but I really wanted you to hear that.
Okay, well, shall I read my organizing thing and then we can all start talking to each other? Okay. All right. Wait a minute. Let me see if I have to find it. Okay. All the years of campaigning have given me one clear message. Voting isn't the most we can do, but it is the least. To have a democracy, you have to want one. Still, I realize this fully only by looking back. At the beginning of the 1980s, I went to Missouri to campaign for Harriet Woods in her U.S. Senate race. I bet there are people here who remember Harriet Woods, right? She was a great candidate, and her path into politics was so improbable that no one could have made it up. As a mother of two young children, she complained about a noisy manhole cover that awakened them every time a car rolled over it. When she got nowhere with the city council, she circulated a neighborhood petition to close the street to cars. It worked. This success led her to run for the city council. She won, served 8 years, got appointed to the State Highway Commission, ran a successful race for the state legislature, and was reelected there too. All this made her a viable candidate statewide. Still, this was not enough for the state Democratic Party. It's going to sound familiar to a lot of people. When it came time to choose a primary candidate in the U.S. Senate race, it backed a well-to-do banker who had never run for anything, but who had written checks. But she turned out to have something more important than her party's blessing: community support and volunteers. She beat the rich guy 2-1. Suddenly, Harriet Woods was in a race with Republican Senator John Danforth. Mm-hmm. He was not only the incumbent, but a former Attorney General of Missouri, an ordained Episcopal priest, and the rich grandson of the founder of Ralston Purina. It was as if she were running against the entire patriarchy. When I went to campaign for her, I could see that all the new feminist electoral groups were working their hearts out, and they were volunteering in her statewide campaign. Though Missouri was often counted as an anti-choice state, Woods refused to budge from her support for reproductive freedom as a fundamental human right. In the end, she won in rural Republicans' areas anyway, including one so conservative that it was known as Little Dixie. But in the final week, she had run out of money and couldn't answer the last-minute storm of virulent attacks. She lost by less than 2% of the vote. It was so clear that she could have won with money to answer those last-minute attacks that her race inspired the founding of Emily's List. And this PAC went on to attract 3 million members and become one of the biggest in the nation, as well as the single biggest resource for women in politics. But Danforth did win. He took with him to Washington an African-American lawyer named Clarence Thomas, who had been working for Monsanto, the agrochemical giant that gave us Agent Orange, genetically engineered seeds, and more. Indeed, Danforth got him that job at Monsanto, too. As Danforth explained, he was very attracted to Thomas, not only because he was a rare African-American conservative, but also because he, too, had studied to be a priest, in his case, a Catholic priest. All this happened decades ago, yet the impact of her loss by a few hundred votes goes on. If you don't believe me, flash forward to the morning after the 2000 Bush versus Gore presidential election, with national results hanging by the thread of a few thousand disputed votes in Florida. I just happened to be speaking at Palm Beach County Community College that morning. Its campus just happened to be in a poor area, and therefore a Democratic area, and I could see that nobody wanted to talk about anything but the election that was hanging by a thread that morning. A young African-American woman rose to say that she had registered to vote by phone, then been challenged by her polling place because Caucasian had been printed next to her name. She never did get to vote. An older African-American man said he had been denied the right to vote because he was told he had a felony conviction, yet he'd never been accused of a crime, much less convicted. Someone shouted out, "Yes, you have. It's called voting while black." Amid the laughter, another man stood to explain that names of people with felonies had been merged with the voter rolls without checking whether more than one person shared the same name. Then an older white woman said the bus from her retirement home had been sent to the wrong polling place. Others testified that polling places were fewer and lines were longer in poor and more Democratic areas. People had given up because they were hourly workers who lost pay if they weren't at their jobs. Then a white man of 50 or so said he'd seen the illustration of the ballot box only on the way out and realized he had accidentally voted for an extreme right-wing candidate when he thought he was voting for Al Gore. painful memories for everybody. That caused a dozen more people to groan and shout that this had also happened to them. Out of approximately 700 people in that one auditorium, at least 100 had been unable either to vote for their chosen candidate or to vote at all. I wondered, if there are this many in one auditorium, how many in all of Palm Beach County? How many in all the state of Florida? Finally, a white man of 30 or so rose to face me. In the name of his military service to his country, he said, and also in the name of his young daughter, whom he wanted to grow up in a democracy, he asked, "Will you stay and help us organize a protest tomorrow, and the next day, and the next, whatever it takes?" I could feel a deep pull to say yes, yet I thought my presence might be used to call this a rebellion instigated by an outsider. Instead, I promised to take the name, address, and polling place of everyone who had not been able to vote at all or had voted for a candidate they didn't know they were voting for, and give them to lawyers for Gore, as well as nonpartisan watchdogs outside the state. I went home, I called the election lawyers, I delivered the lists as promised. When Bush's lead was down to a mere 537 votes out of 6 million cast, the reexamination of ballots was stopped. Florida's Secretary of State, Catherine Harris, also the co-chair of Bush's Florida campaign, declared Bush the winner. Calls for a recount were deafening and supported by the Florida Supreme Court. However, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that there was no uniform recount standard to meet the Equal Protection Clause and no time to create one. It was a decision that would be compared with the Dred Scott decision, the 19th century Supreme Court ruling that no black person, slave or free, could ever become a citizen of the United States for its impact and for its clear bias. Now, remember, for want of a nail, the horseshoe was lost. For want of a horseshoe, the horse was lost. For want of a horse, the battle was lost, and so on. This parable should be the mantra of anyone who thinks that his or her vote doesn't count. If Harriet Woods hadn't been defeated by less than 2% of the votes in Missouri, Danforth wouldn't have been a U.S. senator. If Danforth hadn't been a senator, Clarence Thomas wouldn't have gone with him to Washington as a staff member. If Thomas hadn't been visible in Washington as a rare African-American who opposed his community's majority views, he wouldn't have been appointed by the first President Bush to head and to disempower the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and then to sit on the D.C. Court of Appeals. If Thomas hadn't been given such credentials, he couldn't have been nominated by the same President Bush to succeed the great civil rights advocate Justice Thurgood Marshall on the Supreme Court. If Thomas hadn't been on the Supreme Court, he couldn't have supplied the one-vote margin that halted the Florida recount. If there had been a recount, Al Gore, not George W. Bush, would have been president, as was concluded by a post-election examination of all uncounted ballots that was commissioned by 12 major news organizations. If George W. Bush had not been president, the United States would have been less likely to lose the world's sympathy after 9/11 by launching the longest war in U.S. history, with more bombs dropped on Afghanistan during 14 years than in all of World War II, plus billions in tax dollars given to 20,000 private contractors and thousands killed and wounded on both sides. If Al Gore, not George W. Bush, had been president, global warming would have been taken more seriously. Also, the United States would not have falsified evidence to justify invading oil-rich Iraq, thus starting an 8-year war, and, together with Afghanistan, convincing some in Islamic countries that the United States was waging war on Islam. Without George W. Bush, there would not be the biggest transfer of wealth into private hands in the history of this nation, a pay ratio in which the average CEO earns 470 times more than the average worker. In Canada, it's only 20 times more. An executive order giving an estimated $40 billion in tax dollars to Catholic, evangelical, and other religious groups without congressional approval, often with the appearance of turning churches into a vote delivery system. Without Clarence Thomas to supply the one-vote majority, the Supreme Court might not have ruled that corporations are people with the right to unlimited political spending in order to continue all of the above. Well, you get the idea. The list goes on. We must not only vote, we must fight to vote. The voting booth really is the one place on earth where the least powerful and the most powerful are equal. I still dream about that veteran and his daughter. I so wish I had said yes. I have no idea whether we in the room could have made a difference. In truth, we don't know which of our acts in the present will shape the future. But we have to behave as if everything we do matters, because it might. Thank you. So, questions, answers. Let's see, we have two mics here, right? You don't have to ask a question. You can give us an answer. We could use answers. You can make organizing announcements of any upcoming troublemaking meetings you think this group should know about.
Am I going first? This isn't intimidating at all. Hi. Hi, my name's Robin. I love all of you. So I do a lot of abortion storytelling work. I had an abortion. I tell a lot of people about it. It's kind of awkward. But you do too. And so I was wondering what your thoughts are on sort of the newer abortion storytelling movement to destigmatize things like Shout Your Abortion and the 1 in 3 campaign. Mm-hmm. And what you would say, either of you, to women who've had abortions who are thinking about, you know, whether or not they can speak about it, whether they can tell their truth about that.
No, it's not my decision. It's their decision. And it seems to me that political justice, social justice movements come out of telling the truth as much as we possibly can. It was the issue that made me understand that we needed a women's movement because I went to cover an abortion hearing before the Supreme Court ruling, and women were standing up and telling the stories of their abortions, and I had never told the story of mine. And, you know, it's 1 in 3, as we all know, American women that needed an abortion at some time in her life. It is, it's like the marriage equality movement is the LGBT, you know, it comes from telling the truth, respecting each other's choices, telling the truth, discovering you're not alone. Do you want to address this, Maxine?
Well, I can recall being a young girl in St. Louis, Missouri. And of course, all my friends, about the same age, 16, 15, 17, 18, and girls were getting pregnant. And there was a midwife who was in, across the bridge, as we called it, in Illinois. And it became known to, you know, all of our communities that this is where you go in order to have your womb dilated by this midwife. And, of course, all of those girls would end up in the hospital, infected and near death. But I've always wondered, even though I was young, why I didn't think something was unusual about that. And it was not until many years later, of course, when, you know, the feminist movement began to really help women to understand that they have a right to make choices and that they have a right to good health care and all of that, that I thought about all of those young women who, some who died, I'm sure, or who were near death. And we just considered that that's just the way life is. We didn't rebel. We didn't talk about it. We didn't do anything. And so when the feminist movement began to really make this discussion take place in this country, I always felt a little bit guilty that I hadn't understood, you know, for so many years why women had the right to good health care. Why didn't we have the right to good health care? And why didn't we know that there was something awfully wrong with the way women were sneaking young girls to have abortion and putting their lives on the line?
You know, I don't want to keep people standing, but it occurs to me that I can't ask other people to do what I don't do, right? So I'll read you the dedication of this book.
I read it. Okay.
Dr. John, this book is dedicated to Dr. John Sharp of London, who in 1957, a decade before physicians in England could legally perform an abortion for any reason other than the health of the woman, took the considerable risk of referring for an abortion a 22-year-old American on her way to India, knowing only that she had broken an engagement at home to seek an unknown fate. He said, "You must promise me two things. First, you will not tell anyone my name. Second, you will do what you want to do with your life. Dear Dr. Sharp, I believe you, who knew the law was unjust, would not mind if I say this so long after your death. I've done the best I could with my life. This book is for you." I'm really reading you that just because it's true. I think I can't ask anybody else to tell the truth unless I have, right?
That's right.
Right, okay.
On a lighter note, I am a very lucky 81-year-old by the name of Bibsy.
Wait, we can't hear you.
By the name of Bibsy Mayer Dushanik. I have known Gloria for 61 years.
Oh.
Uh-oh.
I want to ask you whether you have been to London to meet my cousin, Catherine Mayer, the founder of the Women's Equality Party for England.
I mean, would I?
Have you met her? Yeah.
Have I met her? No, but I obviously should.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Okay.
And okay. I'm just saying hello to you.
I actually just, well, not super recently, but recently finished organizing in Arkansas. And I have to totally vouch for what you said about bikers. I was collecting Raise the Wage petition signatures before that actually passed in Arkansas. And the bikers during the Bike Blues and Barbecue thing that they have in Fayetteville totally were into it. It was really unexpected, and it was great. So actually not just a one-time thing about bikers.
Thank you.
But half of the things you said, I was like, oh my gosh, okay, that is what organizing is. My real question is, you hear a lot about war on women, and, you know, all of the crap that's thrown around right now. What is the one thing that you're most frustrated about not having seen come to pass that you've worked for? And what's one of your most proudest achievements that has actually come to pass?
Mm. Oh, that's hard. It's hard to pick one thing. I mean, collectively, the thing that is the most crazy-making to me is that violence against females in all different forms, whether it's son preference or honor killings or domestic violence in this country or forced pregnancies and child marriage, you know, violence against women in war zones, sexualized violence, altogether, it adds up to the fact that for the first time that we know of, there are fewer females now on spaceship Earth than males. And, you know, that whatever form it takes in our lives, I think we're all becoming much more aware of that. Now, if you ask me what is the thing I'm proudest of, that's really hard because I live in the future. So when people ask me that, I always say, I haven't done it yet.
So I am the president of my college's chapter for the Association for Women in Mathematics. So we promote math. So we promote math and we promote women, but we cannot post one thing without somebody saying, gee, if there's an association for women in mathematics, why isn't there an association for men in mathematics? What would you respond?
The Association for Men in Mathematics is called Mathematics.
I have to admit that I am so very nervous right now.
Don't be. We're so glad you're here.
You both have been doing advocacy work for several decades now. And I think out of all of your work and all of your accomplishments, the thing that stands out to me most is that you've been able to push through activist fatigue since the 60s. And I'm just wondering, through all these obstacles, were there moments when you were close to quitting or thought about quitting or considered it somehow? And what was it that kept you going?
Mm-hmm. Close to quitting?
Mm-hmm. And what
every
kept
day.
And what kept you going?
I said to someone just today that if there's one thing that bothers me and probably motivates me to work is unfairness. I do not like people to be treated unfairly. I really truly believe in equality. I believe in respect for, you know, every human being. And I am motivated to fight, you know, some of those evil spirits you see on TV every day of my life.
Yeah, I think actually what keeps me going is that the only thing worse than trying, whether you succeed or not, is not trying. And then you walk around wondering, what if? Maybe if I'd done this, it would have worked. Right? It drives you crazy. So better to try.
Yeah.
Hi, my name is Leanne. I'm going to read this because I was nervous that I wouldn't have the courage to even ask this question. As a Jewish feminist who supports the liberation of the Palestinian people, I've been really moved that you have spoken out in strong critique of the Israeli government, and I would love to learn from you a little bit more about how you navigate your role as a Jewish woman and a Jewish feminist in a time in history when so much of our community is complicit in the oppression of the Palestinian people.
Mm-hmm. You know, I haven't played a big role in the long-term difficulties and heartache and oppression, and, you know, mostly what I have done is tried to come together with women on all three sides and help there to be communication among women. And what has always struck me is that the Palestinian women and the Israeli peace women and American feminists and so on, I mean, we worked out the two-state solution down to the last contract, the last agreement on water rights, you know, like 25 years ago. And the great sadness is that unlike, say, Liberia, where Christian and Muslim women came together and managed to get rid of a warlord regime and at least have a democratic election. And unlike Ireland, where women on both sides came together when governments couldn't, it hasn't happened. It hasn't happened. And it's a huge heartache.
Thank you.
I've been a huge fan of yours for a long, long time since I can remember. It's an honor for me to be able to address you tonight. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about your essay, Sex, Lies, and Advertising, and talk a little bit about what the advertising world was like when you just started Ms. Mm-hmm. magazine.
Yeah, the advertising is really such a huge problem in many ways, but especially in women's magazines, because women's magazines are regarded in the industry as cash cows, as they're called. And what that means is that the advertisers have traditionally controlled most of the magazine pages, and that's why you see a copy that isn't supposed to be the ad, that is about the product or the category of product. Advertising has a lot of influence everywhere, but it has, in my experience, most influence in women's magazines. Some of us remember when there was fiction and poetry in women's magazines and more articles. The editors of those magazines are striving their best to sneak in, you know, some independent editorial, but it's very, very difficult. I think until we are willing to pay as subscribers and not be dependent totally on advertising income, that we are going to have this problem. The educational service online called Ask Linda, I guess, Lynda, AskLinda.com. You can learn anything for, I don't know what, $25 a month?
I don't know it.
And, you know, it's a populist educational institution, no ads at all, totally subscriber-supported, and it's been successful for 20 years, and Lynda Weinman, who started it, who has, you know, a representative employee list, I mean, you know, it's everything you could possibly want, she wants to be helpful with the U.S. education problem, so she is... She sold the business for $2 billion. Okay, it's possible that we can support what we want to support and therefore get what we want instead of being subject to ads that control what we see, control so much of what we see.
Well, let me just take a moment to tell you about a recent announcement, and it's a little bit strange. Playboy just announced there will be no more naked women. And Gloria, as you know, have brought them to this point because she infiltrated Playboy many years ago. But what's interesting is the daughter of Hugh Hefner, who we've known for many years, who took over some part of the management of that magazine some years ago. I always thought that even though she kind of inherited that she wanted to do something better with the magazine, and I don't know if years later this is her decision to try and change the magazine. I don't know if it can be changed, but I thought it was an interesting occurrence that they decided no more naked women.
See, you're a positive person, Maxine. I hope you're right, but what they said was that they were stopping this because there was so much pornography available everywhere, right? And they were doing it for economic reasons. So somebody, you know, emailed me a query about it. I said, listen, it's like the NRA saying we're not selling handguns anymore because assault weapons are so available. I hope she's right. Okay.
Thank you for this. This is incredible, and I'm a little bit shocked that I'm speaking to Gloria Steinem, so that's cool.
Just us here. Just us chickens.
We got this. So much of what you've been talking about tonight has me thinking about the importance of knowing our history as feminists, and you also brought up the 2008 election, so I'm going to be that person who says, what about 2016? looking back to 2008, I think a lot of people, both in Hillary's campaign and her supporters, had some serious trouble talking about race, especially with Barack Obama. And looking forward to 2016, we could have another situation where Hillary is in a general, a situation where Hillary is in a general election against another history-making man of color. So what lessons can we take from what went wrong in 2008 and apply to this possibility looking forward in this election?
You know, if we could just never answer a question from a news reporter saying, which is more important, sex or race? Excuse me? Most women are affected by both. I mean, it is impossible to uproot racism without uprooting sexism, too, because to maintain racial difference, you have to control reproduction. Or it's like caste in India. It's the same thing. So I hope that no matter what happens, we will be 100% clear that race and sex are intertwined. You can only uproot them together, and absolutely refuse to answer stupid questions like which is more important.
I'm old enough to love you both. I'm very curious about what it takes to achieve acceptance as being regular or ordinary. Years ago, the word Ms. didn't exist, and now it's ordinary. And when I was growing up in the 50s in a small town in Pennsylvania, on our coffee table, you know, in a white family's house, we had Life and Better Homes and Gardens and Ebony. So that we got from going to the big city, Cleveland, Ohio, my mom and I went to the Ebony fashion shows. And so with the ticket, she got a subscription to Ebony. I got Jet. I thought that was normal. I thought everybody probably had magazines at home that were different race people. So I've kind of grown up with people of different races being ordinary. I now see Ms. as being completely ordinary because I was Miss until I was out of college, but you know, then we all became Ms. Mm-hmm. How much does ordinariness lead to, or whatever we can do about that, lead to a more general acceptance of, sure, that's the way life is?
Well, it becomes ordinary because we do it. I mean, actually, Ms. was an old term, but to be frank, we didn't know that it was from the, I don't know, 14th century something. We just found it in secretarial handbooks from the 50s for the disaster of not knowing whether somebody was married or not. You know, you were supposed to... But actually, it's an abbreviation that, you know, how they once called little boys and girls mistress and master and so on. So it just means mistress without marital status. And it's actually on tombstones for in the United States from centuries ago. So it wasn't new, but that's academic, really, because it became ordinary just by use. You know, we named the magazine that, and Bella Abzug made a congressional bill to encourage, to require the government to supply it as a choice. It's the same thing. You know, it comes from saying the thing, your friends say the thing, it happens to them, it makes sense, and it grows.
So I think that's a form of activism. Making things, I think that's a form of activism.
Yes, it is. It
just
is
using.
It is totally a form of activism. I mean, think about marriage equality. Just the phrase marriage equality didn't exist.
No, not at all.
Right.
And you really didn't read Jet, did you? Did you say Jet magazine?
Jet.
You got Jet in your house?
Yeah. I was really sad that it just isn't being published anymore. Because, yeah, like from the time I was, I don't know, 12 until I went to college, I grew up with it.
Good.
Hi, my name is Leah, and I guess in some ways this is a follow-up to an answer that you gave just a couple questions ago. Because I would like to, I guess I like to think that the most notable impact on my identity as a woman has also been my identity as a woman of color. And sometimes I find those two parts of my identity seemingly in conflict with one another, especially when you think about feminism and the way that it's presented in the mainstream. Like, for example, sexual assault with the legislative pushes that are being put forward is mostly impacting colleges and military. And those are both issues that do need to be solved. But in some ways, it comes into conflict with what I see as important, because Native women, where my family live on reservations, are completely unprotected when they're assaulted, both in terms of domestic violence and rape, by non-members of the tribe. And so in some ways, I see what is being put forth as the basis for a lot of these conversations, right, excludes, like, the issues that women that look and are just like me have to experience on a daily basis. So I guess it's hard sometimes to get people who look to the Lena Dunhams and to the Taylor Swifts to understand that the experiences of women are very broad. Mm-hmm. And so my question is, first, how do we get people who adhere to mainstream feminism to understand that there tend to be gaps between women of different racial and ethnic groups? And then also, secondly, to put that into action. Mm.
Well, you're standing up and saying it. You know, that's great. And you're absolutely right, you know, that the focus is on colleges, not on Indian country, where the rates of sexual assault are way worse. So there's no competition of tiers. Yeah. You know, tiers are tiers. We just have to keep reminding each other to be inclusive. And it's not easy. The same conversation is going on in India, for instance, because the rate of sexual assault and the famous rape in New Delhi and so on have to also include the fact that judges actually say that Dalit women, that so-called untouchable Dalit women, by definition, can't be raped. You know, so it's always our task to be as inclusive as we possibly can, and to be reminded of being inclusive. Do you have something that you want to happen that we can help happen?
I mean, first, I would like us to push the Department of Justice and the federal attorneys to prosecute, to actively prosecute those non-members that commit sexual assault on reservations. And also, I think, secondly, what would also be important is that for VAWA to not simply be about known acquaintances that commit domestic violence against Native women, but to include a whole plethora of crimes that occur against women on those Native reservations. And I think also making sure that the Keystone Pipeline is not built through Indian country,
right,
where more non-Native men are brought to those reservations and commit that violence.
Right. Thank you. Right. And never fail to... we all learned right now, right? And also, I think that the inclusion of women in Indian country in the Violence Against Women Act was accomplished by one woman in the White House.
That's right. Right.
So, you know, we all have to do it because it matters. Yeah.
Hello. Thank you to both of you for being here this evening. We've talked a lot about feminism. It seems that we're in the sort of space where everyone here at least identifies as a feminist. There seems to have been a lot of pushback either by public women or women who are famous who seem to not want to identify with that term. They call themselves humanists. I think Meryl Streep was most recently quoted as saying she's not a feminist, she's a humanist. And I think anyone would look at her and assume that she were a feminist. Why do you think this sort of pushback on the label or the term, where do you think that comes from and how do we change
it? Yeah, I think some people don't say feminist because they don't know what it means, and if they go to the dictionary and see it means of anybody, man or woman, who believes in the full self, they say, oh yeah, I'm a feminist. And then some people don't say it because they do know what it means and they're against it, you know. But the problem with the first group is that the word is still perceived as being anti-male, humorless, and then there's the inimitable Rush Limbaugh saying feminazi every day. Humanist actually has a different meaning historically because it means you believe in human potential or possibility, not in God. So maybe people like Meryl Streep, I don't know, were adding to the fact that they are feminist by saying, and they are humanist. I find it very painful whenever anybody who actually believes in the content doesn't use the word, because I don't think people would say, I'm not for civil rights, you know, or I don't know. It is painful.
What do you think we can do to kind of change that? Or do you think we should be focusing on the label and not
just keep going? We just, the more we say it, it's like everything else, telling the truth. The more we say it, yeah. The more we put it on shirts, this is what a feminist looks like.
Well, we've come quite a distance. Back in the day, we were bra burners and all kind of names, but that has changed. What I like about the possibility of kind of revitalizing the discussion on feminism is that young women like yourself have the opportunity to really not only create more discussion, more organizing, more work, more involvement, and I'm convinced that is going to happen, and that you will be, by your actions, defining feminism, and you'll be saying it loud and clear.
I'll get right on that.
We have time for just two more.
Wait a minute, I didn't hear the beginning.
We have time for two more questions.
Okay. Two more questions, oh dear. And do you have any announcements? Do you have any organizing announcements that you want to make? Okay.
I have an organizing announcement and a question that accompanies it. So my name is Josie Lair. I run a project called the Men's Story Project. Our mutual friend Michael Kimmel is on the advisory council, as well as Jackson Katz and others. And I want to invite folks here to get involved. It's, as well as you, Gloria, and Congresswoman, it's a project where men are getting up on public stages, on college campuses, in communities, and sharing personal stories that challenge notions of masculinity through the lens of their own life experience. And it is very much a feminist project. I'm finding that it's very much an intersectional feminist project. Please talk to me. It's menstoryproject.org. And the question that I have for you is... I'm also nervous. I'm curious as to your sense of the role of women in bringing men into feminism and feminist activism. Because one of the interesting things that I've been finding with this project is that men come to the Men's Story Project events, and then I hear that they go back to their dorms and they're raving about it and in tears and, you know, telling the men in their lives about it and calling their fathers on the way home and really taking it upon themselves to spread the word. And I found that really interesting in our evaluation study. And so I'm really curious as to your sense of, A, the role of men in advancing women's equality and rights, but then also, B, women's role in getting men into it. Mm-hmm. And the project website, I'll just say, if I may, is menstoryproject.org. Thanks.
Well, I think we need to empathize. You know, we need to think, okay, what would help me understand if I were on the other side? We have to start there and use examples. I mean, when I'm talking to groups of men, I think we all do, talk about the restriction of both roles. And men are often deprived of their kids. They're deprived of developing the full circle of humanity. I mean, they may be in a prison with a wall-to-wall carpeting and people to serve them coffee, but it is a prison nonetheless. And the ability to develop all of our human qualities is precious to us, whoever we are. So, I always... And actually, it lengthens men's lives. I mean, what we figured out that men stand to live about 4 years longer if they're no longer killed by the masculine role, that is, speeding and violent deaths and so on. I mean, what other movement can offer you 4 more years? um, But I don't think that women are responsible for or in charge of figuring this out for men. I don't think that I don't think that African American people or Latina, you know, are in charge of trying to make white people shape up. You know, it's a larger human question, and I always try to start out by saying what I wish someone would say to me, and if that doesn't work, I escalate after that. But there are groups all over this country of brave, compassionate men who are against violence against women, who are out there, you know, taking big risks, who are insisting on parental leave where they work and jeopardizing their promotions by doing so, who are saying, you know, I have to go home, you know, because my kid is in a play and being told they don't have a fire in the belly that's proper, you know, that to good enough to advance them. It's present, and I think we become reliable allies when we see our interest in the other person's liberation too.
Well, I'm going to tell you just a little story about Marlo Thomas that she told me. It was a little joke. Her husband was forever asking her, "Where are my shoes? Where are my shoes?" And finally she said, "Where are my shoes?" And so, and I think about how we relate to each other, men and women. And oftentimes, without really understanding or knowing it or thinking about it, we're forever in a position of servitude. And we keep doing things and keep asking others by our actions to depend on us for all kinds of things. I've started telling my husband, "Don't ask me about the next appointment. Don't ask me about where we're supposed to be and where the vacation is. No, you think about that yourself." You know what I'm saying? Because I found that it had become a burden. It is like, what are we going to eat? I don't know what you're going to eat, but I know what I'm going to eat. And so I've started to relieve myself of the responsibility to always think about nurturing and taking care of others, even though, you know, there are times and there are different things that happen in life where certainly but this everyday way of allowing yourself to be depended on in so many ways, I think, keeps us from helping men to become less, you know, respectful of our independence. Mm. So,
yeah, we do. We do what we see, not what we're told.
That's right.
So the families we grow up in, you know, do our kids see democratic families in which people don't have those kind of roles, or do they not? Are we generally speaking, it's okay to imitate the powerful group, but not the other way around? So little girls may be being raised more like little boys, but are little boys being raised more like little girls? You know, with the same freedom of expression and emotion. We can do this. We can do this.
That's actually a fantastic segue into what I was going to ask. 5 months ago, I had a baby boy. And had I had a girl, I knew exactly what I was going to do to raise a strong, empowered girl. And part of the gift I see of my little boy is the challenge of, well, how do I raise him, you know, in a feminist world and to understand all of these things. And I hope that he comes into full consciousness with Hillary Clinton being president for 8 years, and that's what he, one of his first conscious memories is. But I guess my question to you was just, you know, a good piece of advice to how to raise my little boy to understand, not, I think we're all of an age where, I mean, we realize that we saw the other. We know what that life is like. I want to raise him that it's normal.
You know, I was just thinking when you were saying that, I mean, the old languages, the old cultures, I mean, the Cherokee language, Rebecca Adamson can tell us here, and the Bengali language in India, and a lot of the old languages don't have gender. They don't have he and she. People are people. What a concept. You know, so the question is, who is that child as a unique individual? Because that child is the result of millennia upon millennia of heredity and environment combined in a way that could never have happened before and could never happen again. So if we try to see, you know, who each kid uniquely is, then, you know, we'll have a huge range. Sometimes I think that the world is divided into two kinds of people, those who divide everything into two and those who don't. And I think that we just have to cut that out, you know, to stop dividing everything into two. And masculine, feminine, it's made up, it's bullshit, you know. It didn't. That's the irony. That's the big irony of where we are, because on the one hand, gender doesn't exist, race doesn't exist, class doesn't exist, caste doesn't exist. In real terms, the individual difference is bigger than the group difference, but we are born with brains, you know, much smaller. I don't know, what's 85% of our brains or something develop after birth. And this makes us incredibly influenceable. You know, the good news is that we're adjustable, and the bad news is that we're adjustable. But if we can just keep a grip on these things at the same time, that these categories don't exist, but they're very real to us because we have grown up with them, and we have the fun of challenging them and stretching them every day and trying to figure out who we uniquely are, and support other people in who they uniquely are. And I think we're seeing this much more, aren't we? I mean, with, you know, gender is much more out the window than it ever was when I was growing up. And, you know, people changing gender, people changing... All right, okay, I'm going to stop there, but... I'm just so worried about what's going to happen tomorrow because we met tonight. Okay, so if you don't have to do anything I'm about to suggest. You don't have to do anything you don't want to do. But if you came here, I bet you share interests and values and who knows. So if you try introducing yourselves to three or four people you don't know before you leave and say what you're doing, what you care about, you know, what's coming up that needs help, what... You know, and who knows what might happen as a result of all of us being here tonight. Who knows? Let's come back a couple of years from now and find out how this was a huge point of change. Thank you.